from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, UMass calls off the search for a chancellor for its Boston campus after all three finalists abruptly withdrew from consideration for the job. Also, the U.S. Supreme Court says employers can block workers from banding together over pay and work conditions.
Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority, said that the policy questions may be debatable, but that the law was clear in favor of the arbitration provision.
Also, we remember the speechwriter behind these famous words.
There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
Richard Goodwin died yesterday at the age of 86. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The three finalists vying to become the next chancellor of UMass Boston abruptly withdrew from consideration today after public criticism from faculty members and a faculty statement that called all three candidates unqualified for the job and called the search process deeply problematic. UMass President Marty Meehan says he will not reopen the search, and he defended what he says was a, quote, exhaustive, rigorous process. Meehan called the faculty criticisms of the candidates sensationalized critiques. Meehan has appointed Catherine Newman, the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at UMass, as interim chancellor for now. Joining us to explain some of this is WBUR's Fred Tice. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Deb.
So give us a little background here about what's going on and what had happened with the search for a new chancellor at UMass Boston.
So the search took about 7 months, and the search committee had narrowed it down to three candidates. Those three candidates came to the campus of UMass Boston last week to meet with anybody who wanted to meet with them. Then the expectation from Marty Meehan was that he would get private feedback from members of the faculty, the staff, even the administration, and also students. There were about 150 to 200 faculty members who issued a public document
on Friday night. Mm-hmm.
Saying essentially that these three candidates were not qualified to lead UMass Boston. And Meehan said that in light of this sort of public shaming, really, in his view, the three candidates withdrew. He now says that it's basically impossible to get anybody to come lead UMass Boston, and that's why he's appointed an interim chancellor for an indefinite period.
But what do you make of these strong statements, really, Fred, between the UMass Boston Chancellor Search Committee Chair and the UMass President, Marty Meehan. The UMass Boston Chancellor Search Committee Chair said that the faculty who spoke out against these three candidates are unprofessional. I mean, these are very strongly worded statements to come from the world of academia here. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and let me emphasize what I thought was the strongest part of that letter, that statement. Which is, we find it particularly appalling that a faculty council representing, and by the way, it was not the faculty council, it was 150 to 200 members of the faculty, ad hoc group of faculty, representing a majority-minority campus but lacking a single African-American member, would visit such disrespect and calumny on one of the few African-American sitting college presidents, Jack Thomas. He's president of Western Illinois University, a top African-American female university leader, and Kathy Humphrey. She's the senior vice president of the University of Pittsburgh and an academic administrator from an institution that graduates more African Americans than any college or university in the country. And that is Peter Lyons, the vice provost and dean of Georgia State University, at least its perimeter campus, which is in the suburbs of Atlanta. The faculty that I've spoken to say, you know, this is completely unfair, this kind of criticism. First of all, there were African American members, faculty members in this group that wrote the letter, and you know, they say it's really institutional racism in their perspective is much more than about just how many people sign on to a letter. So they felt that was a really unfair accusation.
Hmm. Now, you know, there's already tension with Marty Meehan over UMass Amherst purchase of Mount Ida College in Newton. How does that fit into all of this? Do you think they're related?
Yeah, absolutely. The faculty I spoke to said they are related. There's a long history of the faculty being ignored in decisions being made by the president's office, and they're still reeling from this decision. By the University of Massachusetts Amherst, sanctioned by Meehan and the Board of Trustees to buy Mount Ida. They feel in particular that they're particularly worried about the graduate programs that might come up at the former campus of Mount Ida, right? In particular, nursing, for example.
Right.
And they feel like it's just poaching some of their students. And that is why the Faculty Council did issue a vote of no confidence in Marty Meehan last week.
Hmm. All right. WBUR reporter Fred Tice, I'm sure you'll be continuing to follow this. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Deb.
Joining me now for some faculty reaction to all of this is Sharon Lamb. She's on the executive committee of the UMass Boston Faculty Council and a professor of counseling and school psychology at the College of Education and Human Development. Hello, Professor Lamb.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of this decision of the three candidates to withdraw today?
Oh, I think it was probably a wise decision on their part, and it enables, and I'm grateful for that because it enables us to have a fairer, more inclusive process when the next search opens up.
And can you tell me do you think, the main criticism of these candidates on the part of the faculty?
I think there were different criticisms for all three of them, and I could go over some of them. You have to imagine that this 150 to 200 faculty members have been emailing up a storm all week and reading each other's points over and over again. So I don't want to go into all of that, but I do want to emphasize that the process was, was problematic from the beginning, and we really felt excluded. And there was a letter that went out to Marty Meehan at the beginning of this saying, we want to choose more than one faculty member to be on this committee. We don't think it's an inclusive committee when they've chosen one of the faculty members and we only get to choose one other. And then, I guess, to have us interview these three candidates for just an hour on finals week, it might have been a rigorous process to begin with, but it was an inclusive one.
So two faculty representatives was not enough, essentially.
No, and we only chose one of those.
Mm-hmm. Now we had just spoken with WBUR's Fred Tice about this. Henry Thomas, the chair of the search committee, wrote that it was, quote, appalling that a faculty council representing a majority-minority campus but lacking a single African-American member would visit such disrespect on these three candidates. What do you make of those criticisms?
Well, I would have to say that a lot of faculty of color are upset about this parsing of people of color into African-American versus other people of color. There are plenty of people of color on the faculty council, plenty faculty of color, and quite a few who are involved in discussing these three candidates. But most of all, I just feel that it's a way to deny our legitimate concerns and to sidestep, the major issue. It's an ugly conversation. I think he's bringing it up right now, and it's a distraction because we're not about head counting. We consider the three candidates as quickly as we could and in full, contacting people at their universities for feedback. And the feedback we got from at least two of them, from their faculty and people who work with them, were not good.
Mm-hmm. And what about this letter from Marty Meehan to the UMass Boston community today that WBUR has gotten a copy of? And, the president of UMass says this was an exhaustive process. It was 7 months. There were, 195 candidates considered, interviews with 37 people, and it was an exhaustive, rigorous review here. And so now he's going to leave the position open for the time being with an interim chancellor.
Well, I have two things to say about that. This exhaustive process was not what we were made aware of. The two faculty members on the committee were not allowed to consult us or talk to us for those 7 months. And so it might have been exhaustive for them, but but not for us. We would have liked to have been exhausted by this search. And then second, I'm not so sure it's a bad idea to have an interim chancellor. I know that Catherine Newman has worked with Barry Mills. The executive committee of the faculty council has worked very well with Barry Mills, and we appreciate some of the changes he's made over this time. And I know that he's been working with her, and she's on board with some of his changes. And I want to keep an open mind to what she can bring to this. And believe me, over the emails, we talked about whether it was a problematic to have another interim chancellor for a year, and most people agreed that it was better to have another interim chancellor, possible chaos for a year, than to have somebody that was not acceptable for 5 to 10 years.
I wonder, you know, we also mentioned when we were talking with WBUR's Fred Tice about the lingering dissatisfaction, really, over the Mount Ida purchase among several faculty members and what happened there. Is that a factor in all of this?
Yes, absolutely. It's a factor right now. I mean, there's been this sort of serious dismissal of UMass Boston as a research institution throughout this, and the, you know, layoffs this year to fix the budget, and the new parking garage fees that will, you know, and tuition, potential tuition hikes that are going to lay the problems of UMass Boston at the feet of the students. I mean, this has been a problem, you know, all year, and it's not just Mount Ida that just added to it. It's this feeling of being disrespected and not being helped out, I suppose, by the legislature in terms of making up for some of the problems that were not the problems of the last administration in total, but longstanding problems in terms of this sort of crumbling infrastructure and the, you know, and the you know, shoddy construction that we're dealing with there. So Mount Ida was just sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back about this right now. And okay. I think that, you know, just to add on to what Fred Tice said, it's not so much about poaching students from us, but that these students from UMass Amherst are going to be coming here looking for internships at sites that we worked long and hard to develop for our students, you know, in conjunction with our urban mission to help our students. And then
Professor Lamb, we're just about out of time, but I really appreciate you taking the time to explain. Sharon Lamb is on the executive committee of the UMass Boston Faculty Council and is a professor of counseling and school psychology at the College of Education and Human Development. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks. Bye-bye.
A divided U.S. Supreme Court decision today has the potential to affect some 25 million non-union workers. The court ruled that businesses can prohibit their workers from banding together in disputes over pay and workplace conditions. Joining us to talk about this and more is WBUR legal analyst and former federal judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
So this case, Epic Systems Corp. versus Lewis, is one of two labor-related cases before the high court right now. What do you think this decision means for employees?
Well, let me put it in context for a moment. These were cases about overtime rules for employees, and it was the kind of case that an individual employee would not likely bring because the amount of money is not substantial, because the costs of litigation are so high. So rather, they brought it, as workers all across the country have done, in class action suits. The employers come back in and say, you don't have a right, you signed a waiver of your rights to access to the federal courts. And, you know, this should be an arbitration. The significance of that is an arbitral panel typically does not involve class actions. It's usually an individual process. It's a confidential process. There are very limited appeals. And so to some degree, it is a considerably lesser forum for the litigation of these claims. The workers came back and said that we are workers. And under the National Labor Relations Act, there's a right to collectively organized, to engage in collective action, and that right basically preempts this arbitration provision. People like us who have a right to collectively organize should not be forced to waive our access to collective access to the courts. Mm. In a decision which we could have predicted from Justice Gorsuch, he concludes that the language of the Labor Act is not sufficiently precise to be able to trump these arbitration clauses. Justice Ginsburg comes back and says this is egregiously wrong, and for 80 years we have interpreted the right to collectively act to conclude access to the courts. But it was a 5-4 majority, and the employers won.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, though, it's my understanding that Justice Gorsuch, he was saying, you know, this is really up to Congress, right? Congress has sort of already dealt with this, and this is a domain where Congress should enter and deal with it. And is that likely then? Do you think?
No. I mean, do you remember the debate when Gorsuch was nominated about this case involving a trucker who had been in a truck and the brakes were freezing and he pulled over and then he ultimately left the load of the truck on the side of the road while he went off because he thought he would die. And Gorsuch, in a dissent, said, I'm sorry, the language of the statute doesn't protect this guy, notwithstanding the fact that the National Transportation Board had ruled in his favor. Gorsuch is said because the federal collective bargaining, the National Labor Relations Act, didn't specifically talk about arbitration, didn't specifically, then therefore these rights, which have been broadly interpreted, are irrelevant. So this is not surprising. And what he's doing is taking a statute that was intended to deal with the imbalance between a worker and an employer, that's the reason for collective action, and saying, I'm sorry, it's now back again to the individual employee against the company.
Right. And who are the workers that this would primarily affect?
Well, this is anyone who would be covered by the National Labor Relations Act, this particular statute. They sought protection for collective action in the National Labor Relations Act, and this is saying, no, you face your employer. If you file a document to waive your rights, you've waived your rights. There's no such thing as collective action. It's only with respect to overtime pay. You still have a right to collectively organize with respect to union organizing.
Hmm. So the other labor case before the court, let's talk about that as well. People call it the Janus case, right? And that would allow union members to quit unions and not pay their dues, but the unions would still be required to represent these folks. So what do you take from today's ruling on this and how the court might be leaning when it makes a ruling on Janus?
Well, again, you have to want to put this in context. The whole reason for payment to unions, the whole reason for protection for collective bargaining is the notion that, that there has to be institutional supports for collective action. There has to be some way to protect it, protect union elections, protect bargaining, et cetera. And one such protection was the notion that you had to pay for union membership because the union bargains on behalf of everyone. So you can't be in a situation where you're not paying for union membership all the while that you're getting the benefits of the union bargaining. If the court finds that mandatory payment of union membership dues is illegal, it will substantially undermine the ability of unions to organize. Because then there'll be an anomalous situation. You have 10 people in a bargaining unit, let's say, just as a hypothetical. You're representing, five of them, and five are not paying. But nevertheless, what you gain for the group will be the group's gains.
Right.
So this will undercut sort of one of the institutional supports of union organizing. And, you know, the fact that it's a 5-4 majority in this case doesn't bode well for that case either.
Hmm. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about some local legal issues. Massachusetts, first off, we recently learned, is in the unenviable position of having one of the oldest prison populations in the country. And although we have a new criminal justice reform bill, this is still the case, and that bill allows for what's known as compassionate release for some of the state's sickest inmates. They can be released if they can prove that they're no longer a public safety threat. But so how is compassionate release dealt with then in Massachusetts? Is it rare? Is it
up until now there's been no mechanism. You had to apply for commutation, making sort of a special pitch that your sentence deserves to be reduced in some measure. The bill provides for medical review of the individual, provides for input from the Department of Corrections to determine the circumstances, and then court review if the superintendent of the institution doesn't give you medical release. What I understand the governor is suggesting, is proposing, is that you take out of this bill first-degree murder defendants.
Right.
Which makes no sense. I think the Globe reported today that there are over 300 first-degree murder defendants. The issue is whether these individuals are so sick that they can't possibly be a public health challenge to anyone. Public safety challenge to anyone. They're so old, they're so sick that it doesn't make sense for the state to be paying some. Again, the Globe's figures were, what was it?
$283,000 to care for someone at the Shattuck Hospital Correctional
Unit.
Right.
Yeah, a year. As opposed to their being released and then with family and friends and taking care of their needs in that way. We are one of the few states without a mechanism for compassionate release. Even the federal system has a mechanism for compassionate release. That was the mechanism through which Sal DeMacy was released only a year ago. Mm-hmm. So it just doesn't make sense as a public safety issue not to have this, and you'll have a case-by-case analysis.
Mm-hmm. And Governor Baker's, as you said, that exemption, but that also comes as Governor Baker has talked about possibly reinstating the death penalty in Massachusetts. So what does that suggest, do you think, about legally what might be happening? Is it a change? Is it politics? What's going on?
Well, if he reinstates the death penalty, it will be a substantial change. This state has not had a death penalty for numbers of years. And the question is, why? Why do you need to do that? Violent crime is as low as it has ever been all around the country, but particularly here. Why? Why do you do that? If there's no deterrence, if there's no need for it, if there's no public safety rationale, so then the question is, is it politics? Mm. And I think that's an open question.
All right. Nancy Gertner, WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge. Judge, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Another school shooting has claimed several lives, this time in Texas.
I was thinking it was going to happen eventually. It happens. It's been happening everywhere. I was ready to run out, but my teacher told me to hide instead, so that's what I did.
That's Paige Curry, a student at Santa Fe High School, where 17-year-old Demetrios Pagorchis is charged with opening fire in the school and killing 10 people. That shooting came just months after the shooting in Parkland, Florida, killed 17 people. The Parkland shooting inspired thousands of students across the country to organize and to rally for stricter gun control laws. But now, after another shooting has happened, how are students feeling? And what's next? Joining me in the studio is Amalia Hawkman, a sophomore at Somerville High School and a student activist with the group Students Against Gun Violence. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Nancy Rappaport, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Rappaport, thanks to you as well. So, Amalia, I want to start with you first. As we said, you've been a student organizer at your school. So what's your reaction to what happened last week?
I mean, my initial reaction is just, this is heartbreaking. And another horrible, saddening reason why we can't stop fighting. And why we have to just keep going until there's no more shootings.
Is it surprising to you that this has happened again?
I don't think so. I mean, we haven't seen any huge improvement in federal gun laws, in equitable funding for schools, and things that are needed to prevent shootings like these since Parkland. So to be honest, I think a lot of people were seeing this coming.
Hmm. So I wonder, you know, you rallied together after Parkland. There seemed so much attention, lots of momentum, lots of protests, and then there's a shooting. What does that do to your hope and your enthusiasm about organizing?
A lot of people would probably say, like, it could be discouraging, but I'm not going to look at it that way, and I think a lot of other young people aren't either. It's just, you know, more fire in our fight to end gun violence.
Mm. So what does that mean? Do you have something specific planned?
I know at my school we're trying to think together as a school of what we want to do. We want to do something, some kind of protest. We've done lots of walkouts. We've done die-ins. I know other schools have started doing protests starting today. But we need to do something concrete because this can't keep happening.
What's been the response from school administrators and teachers at your school?
There hasn't been an official response. You know, we've had teachers who have acknowledged it, who've, you know, realized how hard this is on them and on us, and that, you know, they want to work as hard as we do to end these shootings, but there hasn't been, like, an official school response to the shooting.
Hmm. I wonder, Dr. Rappaport, what do you say to students like Amalia, you know, about organizing in the face of what looks like a defeat?
Well, I'd say Amalia's the voice of the future, and it's incredibly heartening because, you know, we hear often about thoughts and prayers with the families in the schools when events like this happen, and the idea that students will mobilize to help for policy change is incredibly important. And at the same time, what I guess I would say is a reminder that as heartbreaking and horrible that these events are, which they each time all of us feel saddened and stunned, that we have a lot of systems in place to identify when there are red flags and to move in. And we don't know yet about what red flags might have been there, but there are a lot of preventive efforts. And sometimes crises are averted. And the other thing I would say is that school shootings are incredibly rare. It's one in a million. It's a chance of getting hit by lightning in a bathtub. So you're more unsafe at home in a parking lot than you are at school. And so you have to balance both of those sentiments.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. But I wonder, you know, how do you help students process it? Do you say that there are some preventative measures that folks are working on?
Absolutely. And what's also important, and Cornell and Sherris are two researchers who have done this, where they have taken what was the Safe School Initiative, which was from the Department of Education and the FBI, that looked at the school shootings that happened, 37 school shootings, looked at patterns, and they created guidelines for schools to implement doing safety assessments. They call them threat assessments. I call them safety assessments. And what that entails is when you have a student that's been identified as raising some concern, that you look at context and that there's a series of questions that you ask. And that's an incredibly important aspect of keeping schools safe.
Amalia, do you feel safe in your school? Do you feel like you're prepared? And have things changed at all, you know, in school? And are the administrators and teachers sort of helping you understand, you know, what to do to be safe and how to not consider too many things a threat, if you will, right?
Yeah. So my school particularly, it's not necessarily like, you know, it's not like we have shootings in our town every day or every week like some communities do. We have lost two students at the beginning of the year. But our school hasn't, you know, since Parkland, since Santa Fe, they haven't done like a, this is what you should do, or this is exactly the steps you should be taking if there's an active shooter. Which I feel like should be done because there is a lot of fear, whether it's like, you know, it could happen or not, who knows, but, you know, there is fear because, you know, there's been 22 school shootings since 2018 started.
Hmm. And so do you and your friends talk about this? Do you try to prepare yourselves emotionally, or in another way to say, if this happened, I would do X or anything like that?
I mean, we'll have casual conversations because, you know, it gets talked about so much and people will be like, yeah, I guess we'd hide in that corner or try to fit in that closet or maybe throw my desk. But there isn't any, like, concrete answer that we've come to. Mm.
Dr. Rappaport, what about parents who also must be anxious amid all this news? What advice do you have for parents?
Again, without minimizing, it makes me so sad that you would say that there's plans about, like, what closet you could find. I think it's important to remember that schools are relatively safe places to be, genuinely safe places to be, and to have parents remind that to their children, because especially young kids, they get exposed to the repeated TV repetition of it. And I, what's more important to me are, you know, what kind of school climate is when your child walks into school, does this look like a friendly place? Is there a principal in the front of the building that's saying hello? Is there a sense that there's a one of the things that the Safe School Initiative talks about is how important it is to have each student have a trusting relationship with a school adult. Is there a process where if a student is worried about another student, is there a clear, identified way that they can bring up that concern to school adults? Hmm. So all those things.
And what about that emotional toll that Amalia talked about of sort of, even if it is casual conversations, of looking at which corner might be the best corner to hide in? I mean, that...
It sucks.
That's,
I mean, I can't step toe around it. That's absurd that we have to be in a time when teenagers and children are having to strategize. And quite frankly, I don't think those steps are what are going to make schools safer. If you build a barrier for teenagers coming into the school, kids are really smart. If they want to come in and raise havoc in a school, they're gonna like in Columbine, they'll bring them in through other entrances. So then you say, well, okay, we'll only have one entrance. And I think that kind of barrier mentality or arming teachers is not what makes schools safe. Mm-hmm. It's providing a caring environment where there are clear behavioral expectations and there is an understood protocol for if we have a threat, what's done. And the two distinctions I would say for parents and kids and staff is what you look at is a transient threat and a substantive threat. And the way you look at that is around context. So a transient threat may be that a kid says underneath their breath because they're pissed off, I'm going to kill a teacher, or they say, I'm going to bring a bomb to school. And never, you know, of course you want to respond to that. But then you talk to the student and you find out this is someone with an underdeveloped social skills, mm-hmm. and they did it for a rise. And then you look at students where it's a substantive threat, where they have an access to a weapon, they've had a plan. Often there's leakage. So often there are other students that students have talked to about when they're going to do a school shooting. So that goes back to school climate. If mm-hmm. you have a sense in the school that trusting adults are going to respond to a concern, then when the leakage happens, we've had crises averted because of that.
Right. Last word, Amalia. Do you feel the climate in your school is good? Are you fairly confident in that, as confident as you can be, obviously, because I don't think anybody knows for certain, but you feel that you have a safe school for the most part?
Yeah, I feel like I do. I'm not sure I can speak for everybody. It's right. A fairly large school, and everybody experiences things differently, but I know I have at least a couple teachers I can go to.
Right. And despite this, you're gonna keep going, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for being with us today. Amalia Hockman, student at Somerville High School, and Dr. Nancy Rappaport, associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
A Massachusetts attorney, once held up as a system of addiction recovery success, was in court today to face some lurid charges. David Perry, the owner of a Roxbury sober house, is accused of several things, including offering drugs and legal representation to residents of his sober house in exchange for sex. During his court appearance today, the judge denied prosecutors' motion to revoke Perry's bail and denied Perry's claim that he was indigent and needs a public defender. He'll be back in court next month. We spoke with many people about Perry's case, and they say it raises questions about oversight of sober housing and the addiction treatment center that referred patients to Perry's sober house. Senator John Keenan says the state is going to look at the voluntary certification process that's now in place.
Now, we have no control over whether somebody wants to run a substandard sober house, and we are aware that some of them are still out there, and this one is certainly alarming, but we're trying to beef up our certification program to reward those doing the right thing.
Several people in Greater Boston's recovery community say they are not surprised by the 34 charges in the state attorney general's indictment against David Perry. The indictment alleges that from 2012 to 2017, Perry gave drugs, cash, and free rent in his sober house in exchange for sex.
When you actually first moved in, they would say, oh, if you don't have to pay rent, don't worry about it. You'll always go to the big bed, which meant you'd end up sleeping with Dave Perry if you couldn't pay the rent.
34-year-old Timothy Ostman says he lived at Perry's sober home called Recovery Education Services, or RES, in 2016. Ostman and some other RES clients who didn't want to be named for this story agree with much of what is outlined in the indictment. Ostman says essentially he felt he wasn't supported in his recovery.
They didn't enforce going to meetings. They didn't enforce getting a sponsor. They didn't tell you to try to go out and get a job, even if it was part-time.
Perry's lawyer says his client denies all the charges. He says Perry has helped, not harmed, scores of people with substance use disorders. Perry's story is often told as one of redemption. After his arrest in 2001 in a narcotics sweep, Perry was on federal probation for 5 years, and he was disbarred. And his charismatic telling of his story and his offers to help others made him a sought-after speaker at AA meetings and conferences.
If you're one of those people suffering in sobriety, if you're looking around wondering when these hot coffee, cold metal chairs, church basement, shoot me now feeling's going to end, you know, if that's you in this room tonight, please, 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 my prayer is simple. Come up to any one of us who are carrying this message. We'll show you how to do this. Just tell us your name. We'll take it from there.
Perry also secured contracts with addiction treatment providers for residents to go to his sober home. Many residents told us they were referred to RES by their substance use treatment center called Bournewood, which is located in Brookline. They say after they completed detox, they could continue in Bournewood's day program and Bournewood would pay their rent at RES. Bournewood CEO Marcia Fowler says she works with various area sober homes, but she stopped working with RES at the beginning of this year.
Our main criteria for our relationships with the sober homes is ensuring that there is a clean and sober environment. And we, you know, had concerns that the patients that were referring there, that the environment was not supportive of their recovery.
Fowler says Bournewood does its best to vet sober homes. She says staff personally visit the homes and meet with the manager and owner. Fowler says housing is often a problem for her patients because many times people have nowhere to live to be able to continue the next step of treatment. And she says there are not enough sober houses, especially for women.
We're not going to discharge someone to the street. So we would rather discharge someone to a sober home where they can continue to engage in treatment than to have them receive no ongoing treatment at all.
A 2014 Massachusetts law set up a process for sober homes to become voluntarily certified. In 2015, the law required that any vendor with a state contract can only refer people to a certified sober home. Senator John Keenan, who's vice chair of the legislature's Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use and Recovery, says lawmakers will likely review whether licensed treatment programs are complying with that law.
I'm curious as to how we will be able to determine whether programs that are receiving state funding are referring clients to non-certified sober homes. I don't know if there's a mechanism in place right now to make that determination. That's something that we're going to have to look at.
The Massachusetts Alliance for Sober Housing, or MASH, has certified about 160 homes throughout the state that provide more than 2,000 beds. Average weekly rents range between $160 and $185. MASH Executive Director Marie Graves says certification means a sober house meets a set of standards and passes third-party safety inspections.
Right now, the certification itself is pretty strong. And we are really confident with how we're operating our certified homes.
It's not clear how many uncertified homes, like Dave Perry's, are in Massachusetts. Some treatment providers estimate that only about 20% of the sober homes operating in the state are certified. Dave Perry's first sober house was called Safe Haven, and it was shut down amid complaints about noise and drug use. Shortly after that, he opened RES. His efforts to help other substance users were cited as a reason why he was readmitted to the Massachusetts bar in 2014. In a transcript, federal judge Mark Wolf told Perry, "I hope and trust that you will sustain your efforts." But Judge Wolf also said, quote, "The challenges never disappear and the journey is never over." The Massachusetts Board of Bar Overseers says it is reviewing the situation with David Perry and discussing his options with him. Stay with us. Coming up, we remember writer and political speechwriter Richard Goodwin. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Finally, today, we want to remember Richard Goodwin, political speechwriter for Presidents John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Senator Robert Kennedy. Goodwin, husband of historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, died yesterday in their Concord home. He was 86 years old. Goodwin's career spanned decades, and many say he wrote some of the most iconic speeches of the last century. One of them was Johnson's "We Shall Overcome" speech. It's perhaps Goodwin's most famous. On March 15, 1965, as the nation reeled from the Bloody Sunday beatings of civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama, President Johnson made a stirring call on Congress to ensure the voting rights of Black Americans.
There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
Back in 2014, WBUR's David Boeri spoke with Richard Goodwin about the writing of that speech under a one-day deadline.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
So began President Lyndon Johnson on March 15, 1965. He spoke to a nation sickened by the sight of state police and a sheriff's posse assaulting civil rights marchers in Selma the week before. He had an audience of 70 million television viewers who had seen for themselves clubs, bullwhips, and tear gas unleashed against people trying to register Black Americans to vote. The veil was off the injustice. The president was throwing his heft and force into the cause before a special joint session of Congress.
It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country.
The voice belonged to Johnson, as did the conviction. But the lines were crafted by a young speechwriter who arguably pulled off one of the greatest deadline assignments in presidential history that day. It was a Monday, and Richard Goodwin wasn't at his best. He had arrived at the White House on banker's hours after a late night of what he called post-prandial drinks and socializing.
And I got home, and I picked up my White House telephone. There were no messages for me. And I said, good, now I don't have to write it.
The president had decided on Sunday to address Congress the next night. But when the pajama-clad president woke early Monday to the news his right-hand man, Jack Valenti, had assigned the speech to someone else, he exploded.
Johnson looked at him. He said, you did what? He said, don't you know that a liberal Jew has his hands on the pulse beat of America, and you assign this speech to a Texas public relations man? He said, get Dick on it.
Soon, Dick was on it, with no time to spare. Now 82, the luminary remembers Valenti waiting for him at the office that day, jumping up and down. Goodwin had just 8 hours. He started channeling his own ideals and his own experience of rabid anti-Semitism. To deny a man his hopes because of his color or race or the place of his birth, he wrote,
is not only to do injustice, it is to deny America and to dishonor the dead who gave their lives for American freedom.
With incandescent language and the goal of moving men to action at long last, Goodwin linked the marches in Selma to the Minutemen of 1775 at the Rude Bridge in Concord, down the road from where he now lives. He connected them to veterans who fought for the cause of freedom in Korea in World War II. Author and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin says she fell in love with his speech before she ever met the speechwriter, whom she later married.
What you're calling forth are the memories of the people who came to America for a purpose. So it's part of what is a nation. I mean, it's what Lincoln called on in Gettysburg.
Dick Goodwin had entered the White House at 29 as an aide for John Kennedy before joining Johnson as his chief speechwriter. Here on that Monday, Goodwin had a rare opportunity at the heights of power to pour his own passion into a presidential speech.
Here there was no other side. Blacks had been marching for the right to vote. They'd been beaten up in the streets. I mean, nobody was out there saying Negroes shouldn't have the right to vote or the government shouldn't help them. So all the morality was on one side. And I felt that. I believed that and I felt it.
100 years after Lincoln, he wrote, emancipation was a proclamation and not a fact. And the Negro struggle showed a faith in democracy that shamed the nation.
A century has passed since the day of promise, and the promise is unkept. The time of justice has now come.
While Goodwin was giving birth to those lines, everyone bore the brunt of the waiting president's impatience, except Goodwin himself. No one dared interrupt or delay him. Jack Valenti would later call him as lovable as a forlorn porcupine. He said Goodwin held on to his speech until the last moment to prevent the speaker from messing around with it.
And rest of, not just the speaker, but the rest of the White House staff. Everybody wanted to get their hands on a presidential speech. And if you left it to them enough time before it had to be delivered, who knew what the hell they could do?
Pecking the keys of his manual typewriter with two fingers, Goodwin finished his last page, too late for revisions or rewriting. He called those hours his finest in politics. After a ride in the president's limo in a rumpled suit, Goodwin got to stand in the well of the House and see the president raise his arms for emphasis as he delivered what became the most famous line.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
He said, and we shall overcome, and we shall overcome.
In Selma, John Lewis watched in amazement. His skull had been fractured by a police club the week before. Now he sat beside Martin Luther King. As Lewis told NPR a few years ago.
And tears came down his face. Dr. King started crying, and we all cried. And Dr. King said to me, John, we will make it to Montgomery, and the Voting Rights Act will be passed.
There was a sense of profound emotionalism about this.
Historian and LBJ biographer Robert Dalek.
And for Johnson to adopt the anthem of the Civil Rights Movement, and especially for those who had been battling for decades, it made them cry. People understood that this was a transformative moment.
Senators and congressmen interrupted the speech 40 times with applause, at times standing and thunderous. If the goal of political speech is to move men to action, this was Johnson's and Goodwin's finest hour. Southern segregationists slumped in their chairs and sat on their hands. They knew they were done. 5 months later, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and gave Goodwin the pen that's now on his wall.
Yes, it's Richard Goodwin's words, but it's very much Lyndon Johnson's speech.
It is the custom of presidential speechwriters to disavow ownership. Yet Goodwin would join Johnson that night in the presidential quarters.
Johnson had no desire to go to sleep. He knew he'd had a great triumph.
The two of them drinking scotch until 3, hoping the applause would never end.
WBUR's David Boeri speaking with Richard Goodwin. Back in 2014, Goodwin died yesterday at his home in Concord at the age of 86. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.